morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, but do you notice the days are getting shorter?
Oh, well, don't start. Don't start on that. It's a long time before it's fall. There's a month of summer left yet.
Yeah, but you keep saying that, but it's not.
Well, the month of summer will go fairly quickly, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
But anyway, what are we doing this morning? Oh, I see. Well, we're looking forward about 10 days, 11 days, to a special event in Pittsburgh. A great party for all our local OTMers. Come from out of town if you like. It should be a great event.
It's a big party.
And it's for a great cause. So let's hear all about Savor Pittsburgh.
Savor Pittsburgh, a celebration of cuisine, it's titled, has moved up very quickly into the must-go-to event. And we have with us today, we have Merritt Speer,
right,
who is the Director of Development for the American Respiratory Alliance, which is, in fact, the beneficiary of this glorious event.
No, she's not the queen of everything. She's just the Western Pennsylvania chapter, right, Merritt?
That's right. We serve all of Western Pennsylvania.
And I bet you got a lot of people that you deal with, right?
We, believe it or not, there are 430,000 residents of Western Pennsylvania who suffer from lung disease.
That's not surprising.
No, but let's deal with the nice part first.
But we are here to help all of those people. And through the resources on our website, we actually reach people worldwide. So,
and what is that website?
It is www.healthylungs.org.
Right.
And because we're all about breathing, that's what we do. We just help people with asthma, allergies, chronic bronchitis, emphysema. We help people quit smoking. There's an online interactive smoking cessation program we have available. So we reach far and wide.
Well, the event is certainly not, I don't know what year it's in. This will be my second year as a judge. I guess
well,
I should
have. This is the fifth anniversary of Savor Pittsburgh.
Well, it certainly has moved into a prominent position, hasn't it?
It has really grown, and we're very honored to be the charity beneficiary of this event. It was the actual inception of McCormick and Schmick's restaurant, along with the software organization, which manages the area where the event takes place.
Which is Southside Works.
Which is Pittsburgh Southside Works.
Which is glorious. And the event details, can you tell us the date and time?
Well, sure. The event is going to be Thursday, September 2nd, and it opens to the public at 6:30 p.m., and it goes until people can't dance anymore and can't eat anymore and can't drink anymore.
And let's explain more precisely where it is, because when we got there last year, we were a little puzzled. So if you know the Southside Works at all, you're looking for a parking lot area that's right next to McCormick and Schmick's. When I say right next to, it's on the city side of McCormick and Schmick's on the same street. Forget the name. Might be Sydney, I think.
Yes, it's on the corner of 26th and Sydney Streets.
And look for those great big tents.
You really can't miss the tents. There are four parking garages, so there's plenty of parking. And it is open to the public. We will be selling tickets at the door. We have already sold almost 800 tickets, so we're doing very, very well. The event's gotten more popular with every year.
And what it consists of, the opportunity to be able to taste sample size plates from how many restaurants? I think you said 25?
We have 27 restaurants and 5 different food vendors that will be participating this year.
And we have 3 categories. We have appetizers, main courses, and desserts. And I think this year it's very, very smart that we've divvied it up so that, because I was a little overwhelmed tasting, what was it, 40-some dishes last year.
Well, yeah, the judges, I think, have the hardest job because they have to taste all of these things. And last year, we made the judges taste everything, and it ended up being 42 different dishes. It was quite a lot of food, quite a lot of food.
Yeah, it's not just eating either. There's going to be dancing and drinking as well, I think.
Well, there's a wonderful band that has been with this event for 5 years, No Bad Juju.
Yes.
And they're very popular in Pittsburgh, and they really get the crowd going. Last year, we couldn't get people off the dance floor. It was a beautiful night, and we just danced the night away. And, of course, as you know, there's plenty of liquid refreshments as well.
Oh, right.
We have very generous in-kind donations of beer and wine and rum and tequila, and Kettle One brings in almost an 8-foot high ice sculpture martini luge, which is just one of the highlights of whole event.
The beverage community in Pittsburgh rallies around all these events so marvelously, don't they?
They really do. They're very, very generous.
Let's hear it, you guys.
That's a lot of fun.
Let's hear you guys, Southern Wines and Spirits and Capital Wines and Spirits, and all you guys. We're so proud of what you do. And how do listeners get tickets before they go?
Well, getting a ticket's very easy. They can call the American Respiratory Alliance if they want to at 1-800-220-1990, or they can go to the Savor Pittsburgh website and click on purchase tickets and be directed to the order form immediately, and that is www.savorpgh.com. SAVORPGH.com.
Yeah, Savor is spelled the American way.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
Right.
I was noticing I was spelling it with a U.
SAVORPGH.
Americans don't know how to spell. What can I tell you?
Now, how much are tickets, and what
tickets
do you get?
Actually, tickets are only $60 per person, and that includes all the food, all the drinks you can drink, all the entertainment. You can participate in the silent and live auctions. You're going to get a really nice goodie bag when you leave that's full of coupons and little gifts and things from some of our vendors and sponsors. So I think it's a great deal because you can't even go out to dinner for under $60.
No, well, we were there last year, and I had a wonderful time. Anne had the misfortune of being a judge. So,
it's an honor.
It's an honor, but it's also a misfortune, you said. so she didn't have nearly as much fun. But if you come along, listeners, you'll be sure to have a lot of fun. You can look for me, because I'm just going to be wandering around. I'm going to be hanging around looking for trouble.
Well, the good news, Anne, is that this year, the way we've done the judging, is the judges will be able to have some fun. I think the judging is going to be over fairly early in the evening, so you will be able afterwards to walk around and enjoy the sights and sounds and have a drink and relax and have some fun.
And if you want to see a little bit about what it looks like, there's a picture on our website under OTM in Pictures of Anne with Chef Donato Coluccio, who at the time was at Capitol Grill and now has his own wonderful restaurant called Donato's in Aspinwall, I guess.
He's coming back.
Yeah, how about giving us some more ideas of who's going to be there?
I will tell you who's going to be there, because there's some fantastic restaurants. Bisteca, which is a wonderful steakhouse from the Meadows Casino and Racetrack, they will be there. Bistro 19, which is located in Mount Lebanon, will be there, and they have wonderful food. Chipino, which is in the Strip district.
Yeah.
Element is coming, which is actually not open yet, but it is going to be a brand new restaurant in
We've heard all about it. That'd be great.
They're going to do some very interesting things. I can't tell you because I have a judge on the phone. The Walnut Grove, Treetops, Tuska, McCormick and Schmick's, both restaurants, obviously, they participate because they're also the presenting sponsors of the event. Sonoma Grill, brand new restaurant opening in October called Savoy. That is going to be in the Strip District, and that is owned and operated by Jerome Bettis's brother.
Oh, great.
So you know Jerome Bettis. He's a retired Steelers football player who had asthma.
Right. That's right. He had exercise-induced asthma,
right.
Didn't he?
That's right.
Yes.
So his brother has gotten involved in the restaurant business, and they're about to open a beautiful place called Savoy Restaurant and Wine Bar. So they're participating. Willow, which is a favorite of mine. I love Willow. A little Italian restaurant called Bella Frutetto.
Yes, I've not been to that one.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's in Wexford, Pennsylvania, right off the Wexford exit. The Grand Concourse, a brand new restaurant called Spoon, which is actually going to be the executive chef from Steelhead Brasserie and Wine Bar is opening Spoon.
Right, we're going there in the next day or so.
Excellent. Well, Steelhead is participating.
Okay, great.
And Tamari.
And, of course, Donato's new place.
And Donato's and Mitchell's Fish Market. So, I mean, there are a lot of wonderful places coming. And in addition to that, we have a company called Sweetened Dippity, which is going to set up a candy bar, and you can dip into jars of candy and walk away with your own little goodie bag full of candy.
That sounds like such a mess.
This is a great event, Merritt. I mean, I look forward to it, and I'm just so thrilled that it's so successful. So, listeners, you better jump in there and get your tickets.
and it's such a great cause. I mean, on a personal note, my oldest son, who was born in Australia, had asthma for years and years and years and years, and thanks to the wonderful work that people like your organization have done, it's not nearly as threatening a complaint as it used to be.
Well, thank you for saying that. And, you know, asthma, if it's well managed, you can live a very full, very active life. And what we really do is focus on education and letting people know that they can this doesn't have to impact their quality of life. It's all about knowing how to manage your disease, just like a diabetic needs to know how to manage theirs.
But the important thing to remember for this event is it's party time.
Savor
Pittsburgh, September 2nd, Southside Works, and rewind your program if you didn't catch the place where you can get your tickets. Thank you so much, Merritt, for joining us today, and we'll look forward to seeing you. It's only a week from Thursday.
I know. It's coming up. Well, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Merritt. I'll see you there.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And I guess we'll bring you a report on whether it was a good party or not.
It's a lot of work.
couple of weeks' time, and in the meantime, it's time to take a break. We'll see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu, Ann and Peter Haig. And what's up next, Rabbit?
What's up next? Well, two things, two interesting things, two quintessentially American things, I suppose you could say. One is bacon, and a side of bacon. That's a clever word, a side of bacon that you perhaps have never thought of.
That's very cute.
But which you'll find extraordinarily useful. And then after we take the next break, we're going to talk about something else that's very American, which is beer, but beer looked at from an entirely different perspective. So we're taking a fresh view of two things that both of which are probably favorites of yours. They're certainly favorites of mine, and I'm sure you'll enjoy both of them. But first up, it's Rocco, the Boss Hog, all about bacon today.
For those of you who have not heard our next guest, he's making a reappearance. He's our good buddy, Rocco Loosebrock. Brock, I screwed that up, didn't I, Rocco? Loosebrock.
As long as you call me, I'm okay.
That's fine. But, I mean, I really know you more as the bacon freak.
Right. Yeah, I am. Now that we have this new thing going, some are starting to call me the bacon king, though, but I don't want to get my head too big.
I see.
Well, you can be a baconette or a baconer or something like that. There's all kinds of bacon stuff.
Baconista.
Yeah, I like the baconista. It falls under the, you know, raw bacon mania, you know?
Well, what is it that makes everybody so crazy about bacon? It's a good place to start, isn't it?
Well, I would start by saying it just tastes so damn good. I mean, you know, you think back on your life and you go, what are some of the things you remember as a kid? And one thing I can remember is having Sunday morning breakfast the family, and waking up to the smell of, you know, maple syrup and bacon in the house. I just think it brings people back to, like, I don't know, you know, back to that little, they were like a child, almost like in their mother's womb or something. It's just something that they just love, and I don't know, I think that's what makes bacon special. It just, people remember eating it as a kid, and they just love that taste.
Can you just do a synopsis quickly for those who have not listened to your previous interviews with us about your business and the website?
Sure, Ann. Basically, we sell bacon or a bacon experience via club memberships and gift baskets at baconfreak.com. And what we do is each month we send our, you know, our customers or our members a variety of different types of bacon. I mean, and for those of you that don't know, bacon does come in a variety of cuts as well as different flavors. I mean, we have Cajun and jalapeno on the spicy side. On the sweet side, we have apple cinnamon. We have maple, which is just incredibly delicious.
That's what they made the candy out of, right? The lollipops?
Right. They do put some maple, you know, chunks of bacon in there. And we have in total over 30 different flavors of bacon. So, I mean, we've got chipotle. We got pepper, we have hickory, we got maple wood, we got maple smoked. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on. And so what we do is we offer people that come to our site just a bacon experience and allow them just to feast on a variety of different types of bacon. And of course we offer novelty items from, you know, bacon chewing gum to, I mean, you name it, bacon lollipops, as Ann just mentioned. I mean, so we have lots of fun things. And what we always say, and I know it's true, is that our people say bacon as a gift, that seems weird, but what do you get the guy that has everything? I got a new story I'll share with you. Last year we had this guy, he comes to us, he goes, I got six kids, and they're all relatively rich, or in other words, famous, he said. Meaning, he said, one of them's a football player, one of them is a broadcaster, two of them are attorneys, one's a doctor, you know, that kind of thing. And he says, look, I can't get them anything they don't already have. So what I want you to do is I want you to individually gift wrap one package of bacon. And when they come over to my house for Christmas dinner, that's going to be their gift. And he called me back to say that kids were like, oh, my God, Dad, bacon, this is so cool. And how'd you think of this? I mean, and so he spent next to nothing, and he had these people that were that excited about it. So anyway, so that's what we are. We're all about Bacomania.
Give us that website, because we're going to move on to another website. So give us that website.
It is Baconfreak, FREAK.com, Baconfreak.com.
Okay. But then you decided you had to go beyond that. This wasn't enough.
Yeah, it wasn't enough. and actually, we have several websites. We have, you know, and I could go on and on here. We have Bacon Cookbook. We have Bacon Jerky. We have Bacon.com. We even started recently on our Bacon Today, which is our news blog, BaconEvents.com.
Okay,
now explain, because it's not intuitively obvious to me that there would be a lot of events about bacon, but you found out that there are.
Well, BaconToday.com is a all-news bacon website. And yes, there is that much to talk about when it comes to bacon. And
like, give me an example. What would the people saying about bacon?
Well, I'll give you an example of something that was even, reported in the Wall Street Journal this past week. The cost of pork bellies is on the rise. Now,
yes,
they weren't necessarily sure why, but I can tell you why. And not that I'm smarter than the Wall Street Journal.
Demand.
But I'll tell you why. Okay, if any of you have planted a garden, you know this is the time of year when you plant your tomatoes, right?
Right.
Well, what do you think people are going to be? The reason why bacon is in demand right now is people are getting ready to start making all those BLTs.
Well, it is demand. I mean, basically, it's a demand.
Yeah, and supply goes down because, yeah, I mean, all that supply and demand stuff. And that's what will cause the big surge in bacon sales over the next 2 months, because all those delis and all those places are growing their BLTs, especially now with all the, you know, growing locally and all that, delis and whatnot and restaurants. You know, they buy their own tomatoes local, grow them, and they want to throw bacon in there. But that's
okay,
a news story
it.
That...
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what about the other website, which is baconevents.com?
Okay, well, baconevents.com started because a lot of our readers would start to say, hey, you're always telling us about events after they happen. In other words, somebody will give us some pictures or say, hey, there was this really great event that they sent us pictures on and whatever, you know, and we would report on that and say, hey, it was a great cooking competition, all these different chefs came and they made their recipes. And anyways, one of our customers, which was Sugardale Bacon, they said, hey, it would be so cool if you could get the word out in advance, you know, so people could actually know about the event. And we go, you know what, that's a really cool idea. So with that, baconevents.com was born. And what we're doing now is on our website, we have a place in which we can tell all those bakeaholics, hey, there's an event going on, and it's going to be in this neighborhood at this time, and here's their website and the contact information. So we just think it's going to be a place for people to know what's going on in their community before it happens. In other words, you know, we're not going to report on it and say, here's what had happened.
Well, you know? You're right, because I found out that there is a restaurant that's in our neighborhood, a grill, a casual place, that actually has Tuesday nights or bacon night. And they have a full bacon menu, including something having to do with chocolate fondant and bacon for dessert.
Well, we were discussing bacon vodka a little bit earlier on, and Rocco turned up his nose at that a little bit, but he said he does have a group of friends who like to put bacon slices in their Maker's Mark. what he didn't say was whether it was the Maker's Mark on the rocks at the time, and was it the first one they were drinking or the third or fourth?
Well, most of my friends, it's all the way through, you know, until they start hitting the floor. No, I'm kidding.
here's an interesting question to think about. What do you think the distance tolerance is for a bacon Easter? How far do you think a bacon Easter would travel for a bacon event?
Well, I think it's relative, and to what I have seen with some of these events, obviously there's restaurant-oriented events, and I think, you know, people might travel up to a half hour, but what I have found is if there's competitions or some type of sweepstakes associated with that event, people will travel much further for that event. I think chefs I got a lot of pride behind them, so, you know, they're going to take an event that they hear about, and they're going to be willing to travel far. I mean, to show their latest recipe creation or whatnot. So I have, for example, friends on the barbecue side of things, you know, like pit masters.
Oh, yeah.
They'll travel across the country to get a $1 blue ribbon. Okay,
right.
So I see a lot of that going on with chefs. They're willing to travel if they have a recipe, hasn't been seen, hasn't been tried, and they think people will like. So,
well,
if that answers the question.
Isn't that fascinating? Here's another question that, which you can clarify better than we can. The Italians, especially in Tuscany, around the city of Lucca, love a product called lardo. And lardo is just about 100% pork fat. Is that pig pork belly, or does it come from some other part of the animal?
It's the back.
Well, we think so, but we're not sure. What do you think?
I don't know, but I mean, cheap lardo makes me kind of, you know, when I hear lard...
Well, how could you do that? This is your business. You don't sell lard?
One thing I can tell you, you know, I mean, what I know, I've heard a lot of it, it's called cured pork fat. I mean, I don't know too much more about it. But what I should say or should tell you is we don't do any international bacons or pancettas or anything. We only focus on homegrown bacons. So
okay.
You won't hear us writing a story about, you know, and because I actually have an Italian shirt on today, which is almost embarrassing, you know, after the whole World Cup fiasco, but.
But
yeah, no, we don't do any international.
At least you don't have any French bacon.
And we don't.
Now, you should have British bacon. I mean, British bacon's pretty extraordinary because you actually get the whole thing. If you buy a piece of bacon, you get the whole long piece. Unless you want what's euphemistically called streaky.
Yeah, we have gotten requests to carry some, especially Canadian bacons, but I always kind of, you know, as a small business owner, what I have found is the government doesn't make it easy for you to reach out there and work with some of these folks.
Oh, golly, no. The USDA makes life just about impossible for imported
foods. Well, yeah, I would say they make it impossible for the small business owner. You know, the big company who's got the money and the budget and wants to do it, going to make it happen. So.
Oh, no, it didn't even work that way for the importing the Spanish hams. I mean, that took years to get through. And then they weren't allowed to ship it with the...
With the feet on.
With the feet on. This is the pata negra, with the black feet. They couldn't ship it with the feet on, which defeats the whole point of putting in one of those...
But you had to pay for the, if you were a purchaser, you had to pay for the feet. Only to have them cut off and thrown away.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. One of the things that we battle with every day has to do with our wine. You know, we offer wine memberships as well on one of our other websites, and that's more, you know, close to home. I follow a website really closely called freethegrapes.org, and it's challenging because there's about 26 states or so that we can't ship to, and because of those past prohibition era laws,
like
which are very...
Pennsylvania.
In fact, we just wrote an article about them on our blog because they started those... I mean, you want to try to get wine in Pennsylvania? It's like, good luck to you. But they have those vending machines they're starting to put up in Pennsylvania now.
You have to breathe into them. It has a breathalyzer.
Yeah, you have to breathe into them. I'm like, okay, yeah, like, I mean, come on, you know? And like
it's a very
how does that
foolish
work?
Idea. Very foolish
well,
idea.
Yeah, you know, but the point I make about that is you know, you take Budweiser, they can ship to all 50 states. Why do they make it difficult for me, a small business owner, to ship to all 50 states?
Just because they're ornery, I think, is the answer.
Now, we know the answer, but, you know.
Now, here's a way to finish up. After all, bacon is mostly for breakfast, although I'm sure you probably eat it three times a day. But what's the wine pairing advice with bacon? Assuming that you're having it at a time of the day when you would have a glass of wine, what color and kind do you think it ought to be?
Well, you said, I'm sorry, what color?
Yeah, what color and taste type would you think would go with bacon? Boy, I caught you. Not a word.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking. I mean, bacon is eaten, obviously, like you said, for breakfast. Lunch, it's also eaten quite a bit. I mean, I can't tell you how many people order a Cobb salad that has bacon. I think it's the eighth most eaten lunch item is a Cobb salad for dinner. And I think the third most commonly eaten lunch item is a BLT. I have a hard time answering your question because everybody has a unique palate. And what I like is going to be different than what you like. I mean, like one of the articles that we are always asked to revisit, you know, crispy versus chewy, you know, because I wouldn't say you've stumped me, Peter, but I'm trying to come up with an answer that is, there is no universal truth when it comes to bacon in terms of what will people like more. Like, for me, I'll give you a classic example. If I'm going to have two pieces of bacon with my eggs, it needs to be crispy. Okay, but if I'm going to have a BLT, I like it chewy.
Okay, and you dodged the question of what you drink with it.
Oh, what I drink with it? Okay, I'm sorry, I missed that part. When it comes to drinking, you know, the whole swine and wine thing, I think it is very important to take a wine that matches the flavor profile of the bacon. So let me give you a good example. If I'm going to eat an apple cinnamon bacon that's really sweet, I want to have something like a Riesling or something like that. Okay?
Yeah, gotcha.
Or, you know, again, if I'm going to have a sweet wine, or let me give you another example. If I want to have a peppered bacon, I want to enjoy something like a Syrah because, as you know, many Syrahs have a peppery taste to it. So, for example, if I'm going to have that Cobb salad I mentioned for dinner, well, I'm probably going to ask them to sprinkle some pepper on it and then, you know, have that Cobb salad.
And then you'll
have... Syrah with that Cobb salad.
Gotcha. Okay, so it's really sort of all over the map and... You're just dodging the question, you rascal, but that's okay.
Am I dodging it? Did I miss it?
you dodged it very successfully. I was trying to get you to say what kind of wine you had for breakfast, and I think the answer to that one probably is what's left of her from last night, assuming there is any left.
No wine for breakfast for me. I can't do it.
I also thought
the last time I had wine for breakfast, I think I was 18 in Mexico and was afraid to drink the water. I mean, so there you go.
I actually thought you might suggest beer with a BLT.
I'm not much of a beer drinker.
You're not,
so
okay.
No, yeah.
Well, you sound like you're at least having fun with your bacon. Otherwise, you sound a little closed in there.
Yeah.
You're still having fun, Rocco.
Bacon's a lot of fun. I mean, you take other products. Like I said, we offer wine, and there's a lot of snobbery that goes on with wine, or people want to believe that, you know, oh, I'm sophisticated because I drink wine, and that's fun. But people don't act that way when it comes to bacon. They're really down to earth. They're open. They want to share their stories and talk about why they like bacon. People don't pretend they're somebody they're not when it comes to bacon. That's what I have found. But, you know, you read our bacon blog and their comments, very open. You know, you go to the wine blog and you read comments and it's like, oh my gosh, are these people for real? You know, we just have fun with it because people, they love bacon. So, I mean, it's, you can have fun with it. So that's
well,
what we do.
Well, I love bacon so much, I save the bacon fat.
Oh,
not grease, please. And it's a and it's a wonderful cooking ingredient. But Anne's holding up her hand in horror, saying, "Don't do that! Don't do that! Don't sneak that in my food."
We
thank you so much for joining us today, and listeners, it's www.baconfreak.com, www.bacontoday.com, and there is a news item on the website in case you lose contact with that information.
And anybody wants to register their event in advance, go to baconevents.com and just plug it in.
And have a great day and have some bacon for supper.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Ann.
Bye, Rocco.
Bye, guys.
Is monomaniacal a word?
It is.
It's
and,
hard to say.
Probably a good description of Rocco. But all
and,
of it.
And, but also the idea of this calendar. I mean, I found that there's a restaurant here where you can, on bacon night, Tuesdays, get ganache-covered bacon. I mean, chocolate ganache-covered bacon.
Why would you want that?
That's a good question.
Well,
with that, we'll take a break.
Well, we're going to take a break. We're going to take a break with a difference, because right back on the other side of the break, we're going to start into the track all about American craft beer. So stay with us to learn about the great state of beer in America. And a wonderful new publication to help you understand it better.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Anne and Peter and our guest Andy Crouch have at least one interesting thing in common. We both have met, and we both have an enormous respect for the work of a guy we now probably are obliged to call the other Michael Jackson. The Michael Jackson who's a native of my hometown, Huddersfield in Yorkshire, England, who was the first person to really set about the task of explaining beer properly. Wouldn't you say, Andy?
I would definitely agree. He was definitely one of the great elders and pioneers in what has now become known as craft brewing.
Yeah, let's have the full title of Andy's
book.
Oh, yes.
Well, we forgot that's why we have him on the program. Go ahead.
You're reading it. You have the book in your lap.
Yeah, it's called Great American Craft Beer, and a guide to the nation's finest beers and breweries. And we're going to come around to saying, well, why, Andy, why write this book and why write it now?
Well, I've been writing about craft beer and, you know, all over the world for about a decade now as a freelance writer for a number of magazines and newspapers. And then my last book was called The Good Beer Guide to New England. It was just a travel guide to the six New England states and, you know, went around and met the people and personalities behind the beers. But there had, you know, to date there really hasn't been a book that has taken a look at American craft beer. We've seen plenty of books that are global in focus, with focuses on, you know, Great Britain and the brewing of the Czech Republic and Belgium and Germany. But America has just an incredible wealth of great brewing talent and phenomenal beers. And so this was something I wanted to tell the story of those brewers and their particular beers with this project.
Now, these are interesting brewers in another respect, in that if not all, the majority of them are beers which are in bottles, and as such they can be bought from a distance, they can travel a distance, whereas I'm guessing that when you did your previous book, a lot of the places you went, they didn't even bottle their beer at all. You drank what they had made just recently, and that's what they had, and you might not be able to get it again.
That's indeed true. We tried to do, with this particular project, to balance out the entries that we had, you know, the selections that we had from the about 350 different beers. Obviously, there are probably tens of thousands of beers being produced in the United States now, and a lot of them are fantastic, and so there's only a limited amount of room in this book. But I included some rarities, you know, some harder-to-find beers, but also I wanted to have it be more accessible. I didn't want to be writing about beers that people couldn't find. So while there are some unusual ones included, I try to keep in mind geographic diversity, you know, a bit of a balance between brew pubs, like you note, that primarily brew their beer on site and it's produced for on site consumption, versus production that either do draft or bottles, but they can send their beer, you know, quite a distance from home. And we're now seeing a lot of even very small breweries
that maybe only make a couple thousand barrels of beer, sending their beer into states that are several thousand miles from home. And whether you think that's a great business plan or not, it certainly is exciting for people to, in sort of further reaches of the country, to be able to try beer from much further away when they might not have the opportunity to travel there.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. And one of the things you say boldly at the beginning of the book is that this is a great time to be interested in craft beer in America, even though it represents what percentage of the total cooperage?
It's about 5%. So that number is a little bit flexible. We see it between 4% and 6%. But yeah, craft beer in the United States, one of the single largest, quickest growing segments of the beverage alcohol community, and it is by far the fastest growing segment of beer, and it, you know, far outpaces, you know, imported brands, far outpaces domestic brands, and it, you know, it is a very exciting time to be a beer drinker.
You said this is the best place to get craft beer.
I've traveled very, very widely. I've been, you know, through Asia and Australia and many times to Germany and Britain.
And what are your reasons for this? One is the variety of flavors you indicated.
Right. That is, I just got back about a week or 2 weeks ago from the Great British Beer Festival in London, and that's a fantastic event. But really, when you go around the floor there, there are really only about 8 or 12 styles represented. And now the United States sends a contingent of craft beer there, and it was wildly popular with the locals and with people attending the festival, and just among the 100 or so brands that the United States had available there, there might have been 40 or 50 styles. So the diversity that we see in terms of flavor, in terms of taking from traditional brewing styles, these traditional brewing countries, and then adding our own American spin on it, is really a very exciting thing to experience.
Do you have any idea why this happened? I mean, is it just because Americans are just so entrepreneurial they just can't help themselves?
It's a good question. A lot of what happened in the United States is, you know, somewhere in our, you know, not so distant history, American beer really lost its soul and lost its flavor, and it sort of became a very interchangeable widget. If you ran out of one beer, you didn't even have to change the tap handle. You just put a different keg on, and people probably wouldn't notice any difference.
Right,
exactly.
Right.
But then American home brewers, really, when some of them traveled abroad and then came back and couldn't find beers that tasted like they had in Germany or in London, they started brewing their own. And then once they did that and they perfected those recipes, they decided, well, read about this, going back to Michael Jackson. I've maybe read about this particular style, and I can't find any commercial examples of it, but I do have a recipe, so maybe I'll try that. And then eventually they add some different ingredients here or there, and next thing we know, we have all sorts of new styles, or all, you know, American takes on old traditional styles, like, you know, the British style of India Pale Ale.
That was what I was going to pick up on, because you very lucidly point out that there actually is a difference between an English IPA and American IPA, and a lot of it, you say, has to do with the hops. But I have an interesting observation, because when I first came to this country, which was in 1972, I found that beer didn't taste like what I was used to in both England and Australia, both places I had lived. It had a whole lot less flavor, but there was one beer I found that I liked. It was called Ballantine's, and it was an India Pale Ale. It came in a can. It wasn't a craft beer by any means, but it was a beer that had a whole lot more flavor, which at the time happened to be something I was much more interested in.
Certainly, and Ballantine's very, very famous with individuals who were fans of good beer in this
now,
country.
They were in St. Louis, were they not?
They were actually brewed sort of all over the place.
Okay.
Because it was one of those brands, like so many we have nowadays, that have sort of got, you know, ballied back and forth, but that brand was known a little bit, you know, for having stronger bitterness and a little bit of color, which is very different from things that were served at that time. But as you said, you know, the English style of India Pale Ale, which has very much so fallen out of favor in the last 20 or 30 years in Britain, really found a new home in the United States, and we stopped using older English hops like Fuggles and those, you know, that are very traditional within British brewing, and then started using some homegrown styles, classic being the Cascade hop, which gives a very different, less earthy, much more fruity, you know, citrusy, and it's a totally different style of beer when you just change up the hops.
Well, now let's go on now from the background to saying, now if you're interested in craft beer, or even if you're not interested in craft beer, but you think you might be, The Great American Craft Beer Book is a book for you, but let's explain just a little bit about how you chose to organize it. I think you started out sort of light and pale towards dark and heavy with a whole lot of rest stops along the way.
I do, and this is when I organize tastings, you often hear, you know, like with wine, you know, there are certain rules, you know, with beer, people tend to say, well, you need to drink light to dark in a tasting or something like that. And I don't necessarily believe that. So the book has some breaks in the middle where we decidedly bitter or very roasted and before coming back to some other sort of mellower styles. But the book is sort of broken up in these series of different chapters without, you know, without focusing too much on style. I try to tell people in tastings that I do to focus on flavor. You already know the flavors of food and drink that you like. People know that they enjoy coffee and they enjoy, you know, sort of the roasted qualities or the chocolatey qualities of their coffee. They don't need to be, you know, they don't need to be told that. But they perhaps don't understand that there are a lot of different beer styles that could really meet those particular flavor profiles.
Well, there are a whole lot of fascinating nuances, too, in the interpretation of the individual craft brewer who, after all, is a man to himself, mostly, probably.
Yes, that's indeed true, and there are definitely very strong differences between, even in the very straightforward styles, American craft brewers, you know, for even within their own same town, can offer very different twists on beers. But you know, I think people know what they like to drink, but sometimes they come to the table with some beer stereotypes or some beer prejudices, and hopefully this book will help break them down by talking more about flavor and not so much about the nuances of sort of hard-to-understand styles and other points.
I did notice, did I not, that you that this term beer chef surfaced in your book?
Yes.
Okay. That's sort of is on trend, isn't it, for bar chef and...
Yes, it certainly is, and obviously in the last decade or the last 5 years or so, we've seen sort of the rise of the celebrity chef, and I think that's starting to happen with beer as well. A lot of celebrity chefs, a lot of more popular chefs who are in the, you know, popular press, and just in local restaurants are beginning to see the, you know, the value and the benefit of cooking with beer, and also have, you know, bring it back to its rightful place at the table. Wine was often long considered the only thing that could be cooked with in the kitchen or served at the table, but now these chefs are beginning to realize just, you know, just how much flavor beer can add, both in, you know, within the cuisine, but also, you know, just as an accompaniment.
And of course, there's a section of the book about pairing beer with food.
Yes,
there's a very interesting little chapter on what kind of glassware to use. But let's first of all start off with, should you use a glass at all? And then if so, how, you know, what different kinds should you have?
Sure. I always say that, you know, always let your palate be your guide. I think there's a beer out there for everyone. But also, there aren't any hard and fast rules when it comes to enjoying beer. But with that said, there are certainly things that people can do to help increase their enjoyment of a particular beer. And, you know, there are certainly times where just a beer straight from the bottle is called for and is perfectly acceptable. But that is based upon the design of a bottle. It's going to limit your ability to get the aroma of the beer and to really, you know, obviously to see the beer and to experience it. So,
and it can be sloppy, too.
Yeah. Well, certainly can.
Yeah, we actually had a representative from Pilsner Urquell on the program, well, probably a year or so ago. I think it was the 164th or some other funny anniversary of when the people at Pilsner Urquell perfected clear golden lager.
Mm-hmm.
And this young man was insistent. He said,
you always
must put beer in a glass.
It was
designed to be put in a glass, and if it doesn't release as it does in a glass, then it's not going to taste like the brewer wanted it to.
Yeah, that's certainly the case, but I would have to say, like, it doesn't always matter what the brewer wanted. Sometimes the consumer can make the decision. And I'd say, I mean, 9 times out of 10, I'm personally, you know, enjoying beer from a glass, just because, like, you know, the good people of Pilsner Urquell went through all the trouble to make beer, not this cloudy, murky-looking substance that you wanted to keep behind a ceramic.
Oh, is that why they put them in ceramic? I guess.
Yes,
they put it in glass because it was clear.
Yeah, now, glassware obviously sort of develops after that, and we see these beautiful beers. So I would definitely agree that losing some of the experience by not serving the proper glassware, but also, as I note in the book, a lot of these particular kinds of glassware, the brewers have spent a lot of time qualitatively trying to determine what particular style of glass actually helps accentuate the features of, you know, either the aromas or the carbonation levels of their particular beers. And, you know, the brewer Boston Beer Company here in Massachusetts, you know, for their Sam Adams Boston Lager, they spent the better part of a year designing a very specific glass that I would say, from my subjective point of view, really does change the experience of enjoying a Boston Lager. And that's
isn't that funny? Now, the most
interesting,
the most unusual shift, I guess, is from a narrow, almost coming to a point at the bottom glass for a lager or another light beer to a tulip shape, which is more like a, you know, like a burgundy wine glass.
Right.
For
and, just,
the,
and just with the, obviously with it, you know, within the wine world, you don't see, you know, you sometimes will just see a, you know, a red and a white glass, but, you know, there are definite gradations, and there are plenty of wine glass manufacturers that produce very, you know, even within Burgundy, depending on where you're at, or Bordeaux, they have particular glasses for where in those communities particular wine is made. And well, maybe that may be taking it a bit far. It can be a lot simpler
well,
with
they
beer.
Have they have separate, even within the same varietal of wine, they have specifically glasses for Australian wine as
right.
opposed to
yeah, but that's
right.
because, that's
French wine as opposed to American wine.
Yeah, but that's because Mr. Riedel sells glassware.
Yeah, exactly.
And the rest, exactly. And the rest of the world believes in that.
Dear. Now, Andy, how did you get attracted to beer in the first place?
Well, I actually spent a semester in college in London studying, and while I was there, you know, I had been a pretty, you know, pretty typical American beer drinker, just drinking straightforward American lagers, but not a lot of flavor. And but then I went and just spent an evening, one of the evenings I spent at the local pub near where I was going to school, had Guinness on draft, and I had never had that before. I'd
okay, so that was it. So that was your aha moment.
That was my gateway beer, and that really led to when I first had that beer. You know, plane tickets were cheap at that point, and I was pretty young, so I, you know, the next weekend I got a flight to Dublin and went to the Guinness brewery and went on my first brewery tour.
Uh-huh.
And then when I got back to the United States, it was really in the beginning day, you know, when the craft beer movement was sort of taking off, and there was a local brew pub in my college town that made a different stout. And when I tried that stout, it tasted completely different than Guinness. And so that was when I really, you know, realized and experienced that flavors, even between styles, could be very different. And then that really piqued my interest.
And the world's a funny place. You remember Wicked Pete's Ale?
Yeah, I do.
Pete's Ale, and Wicked Pete. They said, "Tell Wicked Pete, keep your day job."
Yeah.
And Wicked Pete worked for one of the large networking companies in Silicon Valley until he got so busy making beer, he just decided he had to quit his day job after all.
Yep. And then he eventually went on to sell that brand to another beer marketing company, and now he actually makes chocolates.
Oh, no kidding.
What's it called?
It's Pete's, I think it's Wicked Pete's Chocolate Company or something along those
really?
Lines.
Really?
Yeah, and actually they're quite good.
And there are lots of fabulous characters. Low-key guys like Tom Pastorius here in Pittsburgh, who's Penn Brewery. He's back in business again. You know, he bought it back.
Yes, I was very happy to read that. You know, there was a lot of folks who, you know, were big fans of his German-style beers and very sad when, you know, he went through some of the trouble that he went through, you know, with, you know, trying to maintain that location, and we're very happy to hear that he's back in business.
And then you got Sam Castiglione from Dogfish, who's got to be just about the maddest when it comes to the ingredients he assembles sometimes.
Yeah, they make some very unusual styles of beer, but they're, you know, a very smart company, but they are always inventing, always wanting to try something new, which is part of their charm and part of their appeal for people. You know, they definitely create a lot of buzz and a lot of interest around their brands.
Now, I got two tough questions for you before you go. Pick two favorite beers out of all the ones in the book, and then the next question is, if someone says, you know, I'm really interested in finding out about craft beer because all I ever drank was Budweiser, where would you suggest they start?
Sure. When I'm asked, you know, with some frequency what my favorite beers are, and my response is always whatever the next round's going to be, because I, like many, you know, beer enthusiasts, am very interested in trying new things and trying to see, you know, what a brewer has up his sleeve. But I personally, I grew up in the Midwest, and I'm, you know, there's a long history there of lager beer, and so I am, while it's very difficult to pick out particular beers, I am a great enthusiast of the underappreciated styles of lager. And, you know, good German-style Pilsner, like, you know, from Pennsylvania, the Victory Prima Pils, or Sly Fox, a smaller brew pub operation near Philadelphia, makes another Pilsner beer that's really quite fantastic. But,
right.
You know, Victory makes some great lager beers. As to what I would recommend for an individual who is, you know, just sort of starting out in the area of craft beer and are trying to transition a little bit. I think the book does a good job of sort of talking them through some basic flavors, but one of the things the book recommends is that the surest fire way to get into craft beer and to, you know, without having to spend much money is to go to your local brew pub. They are really the foot soldiers on the front lines of the craft beer movement. And you can go into your local brew pub in most places, you know, most parts of this country, you can be within 10 or 15 miles of a brew pub. And you go in there and you just ask for the sampler. And that may cost you, you know, they'll get you 5 or 6 or sometimes as many as 10 3-ounce pours, 4-ounce pours of all of their beers for maybe $5 or $6. And you can work through the beers, having as much or as little as you want, and really begin to understand the flavors and, you know, to see what styles you like. And then try going to your local grocery store, your local liquor store, and buying 1 or 2 bottles in that style. And that's maybe another $2 or $3 out of your pocket. And then you can see what you like and what you don't.
Great. Well, it's the other thing you forgot to mention is that, of course, you have to get a copy of this book.
I usually leave that for the host to suggest. But I think that this book does a good job of really laying out, you know, the philosophy that there is a beer out there for everyone. And I think we can all take a very simple flavor-based approach, realize we already know what we need to know. We're already well-equipped to taste these types of beers. And then hopefully the book will help break down some of the stereotypes and some of the prejudices and help people experience wealth of, you know, fantastic craft beer that's available in America today.
Great. Well, soon today, you and I separately, because we're a distance apart, are going to raise a glass to the other Michael Jackson, the much more important one in the history of beer. We thank you so much for joining the program and sharing your ideas and thoughts with you. And listeners, the book will shortly be available on the On the Menu Radio bookshelf. And you can get it in your favorite local bookstore as well. And if you want to explore beer, you need to have a copy. Thank you so much, Andy.
It's wonderful, Andy.
Thank you guys very much. And you guys enjoy your next round.
Yes, you too.
Take care.
Bye. So now it's time for another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I was just thinking.
Oh, dear, that's dangerous.
Dangerous. We've really been drinking a lot lately.
We have, haven't we?
Yes, and there seems to be a cultural focus on alcohol. Do you think it's related to the economy in any way?
I don't know. I really don't know.
And we've done cocktails and vodka and
craft
beer.
A freak of what is coming at us from cyberspace and the marketplace. And here's another example of it, because it's a fascinating new to the United States but ancient in its origin beverage coming from Japan. And without further ado, Benitomo something shochu.
Listeners, you're going to learn about something new in today's interview. I hope you actually learn something new every time we do a program, but this one is new for us as well. We're going to be talking to Tets Mogi. Is that correct, Tets?
Yeah, that's correct, yes.
And we call you Mr. Mogi?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. And you're going to tell us about, you're from a company which is a distributor called JFC.com, but you're going to be telling us about not only shochu, we'll probably start with understanding what that is, and how your product that you are distributing is even more specific, Benitomo Goma shochu. And I understand that goma means sesame, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, well, tell us about the product. Is it common in Japan?
Well, maybe I should get started with the explanation, a brief explanation of shochu in general, and then getting into Benitomo, the specific brand, later
right.
on.
That sounds fine.
Yeah, shochu, it's a distilled spirit. It's made in Japan. It's a southern region of Kyushu. There's an island called Kyushu. It's produced mainly in there. And it's a distilled spirit, like vodka or gin, but it has a lot lower alcohol content than vodka, about around 20 or 24 here in the United States. Whereas sake, it's a brewed liquor with alcohol percentage of around 15-16%. And in Japan, it's usually drank just how you would a vodka, a neat, straight up, or on the rock. And shochu is also drank diluted with water, And but the most common ways, we would dilute it with hot water.
With hot water? See, yeah. We've been keeping it in the refrigerator. That's
now,
probably bad.
Now, is shochu, is it a pre-dinner drink or an after-dinner drink or both?
It's an all-rounder. You can drink it as an aperitif or you can... It's most liquor from Japan, it's designed so they can enjoy it with the meal, during the meal.
Oh, okay.
And so shochu would go with any Japanese cuisine. With in Kyushu, where it's originated, they eat a lot of pork down there. So it would go with pork chops, sautéed pork, with fish cake, with any of those.
So it's a sort of like an alternative to go with Japanese. It's an alternative to sake to drink with Japanese food.
Sure. It can be alternative to sake. And there had been, we don't know when shochu originated in Japan. There's been transcripts dating back to the 1500s when the Portuguese missionaries landed in Kyushu. And so it's grown since then. And there had been a big boom in Japan domestically for shochu because there had been an image regarding shochu as something where dads, fathers would drink. And relatively, it wasn't popular among young people.
Yeah, it wasn't hip, huh?
Right. But there's a big boom around 2003, and the health aspects had been focused on. There's been studies where it has been proven, but there had been studies where it was a low-calorie beverage, and there's been studies where it prevents heart attack, lower diabetes. So with that, there was a big boom, and many people who were not drinking shochu, who had a bad image of shochu, all of a sudden started drinking shochu. And in 2003, it actually surpassed the amount of distribution of that of sake. So it is now the biggest selling, or next to beer, a liquor product in Japan.
Oh my goodness. Well, now, your particular product is a more specialized version of this general drink called shochu.
Yes, that's correct. Shochu, mainly, it comes from three ingredients. The most common ones are sweet potato, barley, or rice. But the drink we'll be talking about today, Beni Otome, it's derived from sesame. It's one of a kind. It's actually the only distillery in Japan, or for the whole world, for that matter, that makes shochu out of goma, sesame.
I never could understand how it could be low-cal if it's made with sesame seeds that are loaded with calories.
Well, it's in the base, if I read the label correctly, the base is actually wheat and rice.
That's correct.
Plus sesame on top of that, all in the same distillation. And if you're listeners, if you're looking to get a handle on this flavor profile wise, let me just say that my first reaction was it tasted like a mixture of vodka and sake. Now that's not doing it justice because the flavor is a lot more subtle than that. But if you're looking for a space where it would fit, that to me is where it would fit.
Right. The distillery, their intention through this Beni Otome is to make a shochu, which is most shochu is very neutral in flavor. But their intention was to make one that would equal that of whiskey or cognac, and something that the Western world could enjoy. So I think the taste could be compared to that of a fine cognac or bourbon or scotch. It has many flavors that other shochu doesn't.
Yeah, you can taste this. You can even smell the sesames.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're roasted first, as I read the label.
That's right.
Now, the packaging that arrived when you sent us a sample, the package, is that what the packaging looks like in Japan? It's a very handsome shape of glass.
Right.
With a very elegant label, of course, with some wonderful calligraphy on it.
Yes. The package, that's an import label, or rather an export label for them. And the ones that are circulating in Japan, they look a little different. But they made this export label to suit the Western.
Now, has it been going? You started introducing this into the United States how long ago?
It's been about 4 years, 5 years, and it's been growing steadily since. Especially ever since it received an award at the Mon selection, I believe in 2009. The sales have been very, we've seen a lot of growth in sales.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's wonderful. Isn't that great? It's always nice to introduce a new product and have it recognized and have it be successful. You must feel very good about that.
Oh, right. It's our mission as a Japanese and Asian food distributor to introduce new Japanese and Asian food and liquor to the United States market.
Well, so were you introduced to it, or did it find you?
Well, this one, we've been negotiating with them for a long time because we knew its brand presence in Japan, its value, and how much it's sought after in the domestic market. But they're a very small distillery. They don't have, they don't make excess amount of product. So we had been negotiating with them for a long time in order for them to export it. And in the United States, there's different standards for importing hard liquor, and which means we have to have them make a spec specialized for exporting. But they realized the market in the United States, the potential and the need, demand for it. And so we've had a good partnership ever since.
Well, that's terrific. Now, how do people find some of this? In their local bar or in the through a liquor store if they want to buy it for themselves?
Right. It's distillery, the Beni Otome Distillery's intention that to have this in every bar in the world, just like how you would find a Campari or vermouth in any bar. So that would be our goal. But as of now, the circulation is not that it's a little bit more obscure. There's a bit of a premium to it. So you can find it in a lot of the Japanese restaurants, not to mention the Japanese grocery stores.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now in Pennsylvania, are you in Pennsylvania, which is, of course, a liquor-controlled state? Are you in our system?
Pennsylvania, I think we've yet to explore that market regarding this product.
Well, you don't take any online orders, huh?
No, there's. I understand there's many restrictions on that, and we haven't got around. Since we're a distributor, we don't do retail.
Now, how would people be able to find out where they can buy it in their neighborhood?
Well, one thing is you can drop us a line. You can go into our website, jfc.com, and simply drop us a line. Ask us, tell us your location, and we'll be able to locate the nearest retailer or a restaurant that carries the Beni Otome product.
Great. So you're going out through wholesale distribution to liquor stores, and then are you selling direct to restaurants?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, I wish you very good luck. And if you're not going to one particular place in New York City, it's one of the finest restaurants in New York City. It's a restaurant called Le Bernardin, and the sommelier there served us sake with a course that we had when we dined there at lunch with him, and I'm sure he'd be intrigued by this particular spirit. So they're not on your list of customers. Let me know, and I'll give you his email address.
All
you
right.
can get in touch with him.
All right.
And you got to go to your namesake restaurant in Sydney, Tetsuya's.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, we have a subsidiary down there, and I'll be sure to let them know.
Oh, yes, do.
Great. Well, we wish you continued success. We've been enjoying an unusual beverage over the last few days, and we'll be sad when our supply runs out, but it will. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it, on the menu for another week. We hope we'll see you again, same time, same place, and we'll be in a different place because we'll be producing in the field in the state of Maine, something that's always going to be quite an adventure. We're trying to escape the summer heat, find out what maniacs have to offer.
You're trying to escape the summer heat.
Well,
I never want to escape the summer heat.
Well, okay, but you said it was getting pretty hot around here and it should be cooler someplace else, so off we go. And in the meantime, between now and next week, we'll say
bye-bye.